With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS. You're with George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. And today we have the journalist John Helmer with us today. If you're not familiar with John Helmer, well, he was born in Australia, graduated in political science from Harvard University, and he worked in the White House as an aide to President Jimmy Carter. He's also the longest continually serving foreign correspondent in Russia and the only Western journalist to direct his own news bureau, independent of a single national commercial tie. He set up his first bureau in 1989, making him today the doyen of the foreign press corps in Russia, and he certainly does stand out by himself. Helmer has also been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, an advisor to government heads in Australia, Greece, the U.S., and Sri Lanka. He's a regular presenter on Russian topics in China, Western Europe, the U.S., and at conferences organized by the Center for Management Technologies, the Vicenza Fair in Italy, and other conventions. Today, he is one of the most widely read Russia specialists in the business world, and he should be. With the experience he has, he's definitely earned those kudos. And we're going to start the discussion with his new book, Australian Fascism, How It Destroyed the Courts. John, how are you? Thank you for coming by today.
Thank you. Good afternoon, George.
When you started writing this particular piece, tracing down all the threads to it, how, as an Australian, how shocking was it for you that the government would be doing this kind of thing? Because, I mean, to make people pay for their own detention is kind of mind-boggling in terms of the political direction it's taking.
That's right. Many people have suffered through the 2 years of pandemic and understood that emergency powers, when exercised by governments, can be used for all sorts of reasons, quite apart from the medical ones. The story of the book is essentially the story of a law case that we fought for the last 2 years after I was locked into Australia, couldn't get out. My wife was locked out of Australia, couldn't get in. This was an accident of our movement around the world, and it was an accident befell many people. But in the case of Australia, the emergency powers used by the then Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, were to, first of all, do what no one else in the world did, which was to prevent citizens from returning home and prevent citizens and foreigners from leaving. That was a combination which no one else in the world invented. Morrison then politically did a few things to try to save his re-election, because the advance of the pandemic moved his public opinion polls and support in the country from the low 30s to the mid 60s. So COVID-19 was very good for the prime minister of the country as he faced re-election. Then he did to world-famous tennis champion Novak Djokovic what he did mm-hmm. to other Australians. And what Djokovic faced was detention at the border, a form of torture. He was interrogated by several teams of interrogators from the federal government from 1 o'clock in the morning to 7 o'clock in the morning, in the hopes of triggering on his part an outburst that would have him declared a persona non grata. He refused. He was courteous. He put up with the abuse, which later an Australian court ruled to have been abusive emergency power. abusive emergency power in the Djokovic case got him released for a few hours, and then he was evicted on the grounds that an Australian court found, a federal court, the chief judge of the federal court found that so long as a minister of state wasn't irrational, certifiably mad, the government could be satisfied that an individual represented a security risk. Djokovic was considered a security risk, not because he was the world champion tennis player, but because he was publicly identified as declining to be vaccinated. He wasn't at the time a medical threat to Australia. That was medically right. proven, but he represented a propaganda threat to the government's line. Out he went. In our case, the legal case that has been fought in Sydney courts, compulsion under police guard to go into quarantine was exposed by an accident of Foreign Freedom of Information Act releases to resulted from a secret meeting of state ministers following their direction from the Australian Prime Minister on developing a scheme for forcibly quarantining all international arrivals at the airport, making them pay for it instead of the taxpayers of the federal government or the state government, and then submitting them to testing, PCR testing during their confinement, all in order to protect the Australian community from the virus from abroad. In fact, according to the Freedom of Information Act materials that we were lucky enough to obtain and which spilled out accidentally, which the court refused to accept, in fact, one third of the arrivals were somehow never submitted to quarantine. No explanation from government. Yep. And this was a discovery very late in the court process. Only 375 positive COVID infections were discovered in 22 months of the quarantine. And when we matched those tiny numbers against the significant infections identified by the state health officials outside quarantine but attributed to abroad, it was clear that the entire quarantine system was not only abused by the state officials, but had not protected and didn't protect the community of the state and the country for the reasons given. I've tried, that's a hell of a lot to swallow at the beginning of this program, but that's what the story's about. Now, it's a story of a court case in a city at the bottom end of the world. But if the emergency power can be exercised against people in a country calling itself a democratic country like a country of Australia, if lawlessness becomes the rule of law or the rule of order, as it was at that time and subsequently, then it can happen in any country, those of you who are listening.
What would happen if the people couldn't afford to pay for their detentions?
There was a provision. There was a provision that people without means could apply for relief, and that provision was applied in a very tiny percentage of cases. There was that provision, but in practical effect, it was insignificant.
Mm-hmm. How long were you and your wife separated?
A year.
For an entire year. Australia kept its own people out of the country for an entire year, even with all the developments. Wow.
Yes, it did. And in some cases, the numbers are simply impossible to verify, but up to 100,000 Australians were banned from the country for up to a year or more. We suffered for a year, but others suffered for longer. And what happened to them abroad is a story that hasn't been told.
Okay, well, I'm guessing that you're going to be writing on that. So, you know, we can leave off on that if you want. What about the foreigners in Australia that were stuck there? I mean, there must have been some kind of outrage, outcry, lawsuit, something.
George, you're quite right. There ought to have been. And if you were in North America, if you're in Canada, the United States, or in Europe, indeed, there would be recourse to the law courts to find remedies for violations of constitutional rights, violations of existing law. In fact, in Australia, there was one case of an Australian who was in Bangalore, India, who appealed against a federal government decision to threaten to imprison him if he flew out of India and attempted to return to Australia. The federal judge dismissed that case. There hasn't been a case, hasn't been a single court case in federal courts or state courts of Australia in which a judge ruled that the exercise of emergency power under the statutes that were applied by ministers of state were used abusively or illegally. Constitutional rights in Australia were essentially cancelled. What makes this book a novelty, what made the court case unusual and interesting outside of Australia, is the documentation of the way in which state officials, when speaking among themselves secretly, intended a scheme to violate the parliament, the press, and the courts. They actually say, we're intending to prevent public scrutiny of what we're about to do. Now, in Australia, and Australia's not unique, France, Germany, the United States, Canada, many countries, during the 2 years of pandemic, experienced the total abrogation of parliamentary power. Parliament simply opted out for political reasons. Opposition and government understood that they would lose elections if they did not, they thought, follow and impose emergency powers. That was one thing. The courts of Australia were destroyed by this. And there's a tale of in the book, of how quarantine was applied against pigs many years earlier, in which a federal court judge ruled that quarantining pig meat to prevent pigs, virus-infected pig meat from infecting Australian pigs and damaging the food chain, which a federal court ruled that medical evidence did not support the imposition of the quarantine power. He was immediately overruled, that was almost 20 years ago, by a federal court full bench, which made the same ruling that in the Australian court system, emergency power exercised by a minister of state who's not certifiably mad, who's not acting irrationally, does not depend on medical evidence. Does not depend on medical evidence. I mean, consider that. So
that's
you lose,
the entire out. They can do whatever they want.
That was the discovery. That's the discovery of this book. Yes.
Well, it's not a matter of can, but will Australians get their minds wrapped around this? As you know, this wasn't just overreach. This is going into an area that democracies, people in democracies, aren't familiar with. It really is.
You're right.
And they're plotting, which is, you know, this is a cabal, this is a conspiracy to take away your rights, to take away your right to know about the conspiracy, to take away your rights to do anything about this. You know, it's like saying, put it in on TV, hi, we're the federal government, We have guns. You don't. We're coming by your house today. You have to be home at 4:30 so we can shoot you, but you can't protect yourself.
Let's not use the word conspiracy, George, because that's a funny red flag that triggers entirely incorrect understandings. You said quite correctly, George, that a group of government officials, and we're not simply talking about Australia now, can use force.
Right, exactly.
To defraud you and then apply such a level of propaganda through the media, the mainstream media, the alt media, the radio, the television, and so forth, to convince you that what's happening to you is what you deserve and that you have no recourse in law, in constitutional right, in human right. The combination force, fraud, and propaganda, when applied in a state, any state, that combination creates a state of fascism. That's the meaning of fascism. We don't need to speak of conspiracy. The book is an example of a lucky break. We uncovered, through a Freedom of Information Act release, a document, essentially a minutes of a meeting, July 12, 2020, in which high state officials decided to come up with a scheme to avoid Parliament, avoid the press, and avoid the courts, to charge people for their detention. The document itself refers to other documents and other meetings preceding that meeting, and a process which would, in the normal course of doing government business, lead to those officials joining together and exchanging documents until they got all their regulations in order. Those other documents, we issued a subpoena to obtain. And the courts, the Chief Commission of State Revenue replying, said, I don't have any of those documents, using the forms of English in which he meant, I don't hold it in my hand. However, the subpoena was written very carefully to show that by holding a document was meant what lawyers call constructive possession. That means not holding physically a piece of paper in your hand. It means holding in any form whatever a part of a document or a part of a record digitally or by any other form. The courts refused to honor our subpoena and accepted.
Are these judges reticent to challenge state power, which would be, you know, in the United States, it would be a different branch of government. I'm not sure how that works in Australia. But is that what's causing this? Or
it's a good question, George. And each country is a little different. But yes, in the American system, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, and the United States, the judiciary is ostensibly independent, independent of the executive branch of government, the premier, the government, officials, ministers of state, and independent of parliament. However, judges are appointed by ministers, or in the state of New South Wales, by the Attorney General of New South Wales, who gets his running orders from the Premier of New South Wales, who gets her running orders from the Prime Minister during the pandemic. Ostensibly independent, but in practical terms, not independent.
No, I get it. So it's essentially independent contractor working for the team is what it sounds like on this.
That sounds
I think it's just crazy because of just the way COVID panned out. It is no more dangerous than a regular flu. It never was. And you know, that medical data is out. It is just a flu.
Well, let's be clear, George. The court case was not about COVID-19. It was not about medical evidence. It was about the decision to quarantine people forcibly for a medical and public reason, yes, but quarantine them and make them pay. Now, the federal statute under which the power was initially exercised and then devolved to the state, the federal statute clearly said, when the state does that to you, the state must pay the bill. However, no one in Parliament, not state Parliament nor federal Parliament, ever raised that issue until we went to court on it. And we were basically dismissed every time we raised it. So the issue in the court case does not involve readers having, or listeners to this program, having to ask themselves what was COVID-19. It's not about a conspiracy, a medical conspiracy. None of those terms, the word conspiracy doesn't appear in the book, folks. Remember this. Mm-hmm. This is a book you can buy about a state of lawlessness, about fascism coming to your front door, and there is not a single use of the word conspiracy in the book. And the reason for that is simple. The reason is that under emergency power, courts no longer function. The press acts as a propaganda mouthpiece for the state, and state officials do what they want that benefits them personally in their pocket and benefits them politically by getting themselves re-elected. So this is an example of that. And since you raised the issue of Donbass and the Ukraine war, George, we can go on to the international issue, which is destroying Europe and involving all of the world in a war between the United States and its allies against Russia. And then you ask yourself, wherever you are, how come there is a level of race hatred to fuel this war, to propagandize this war, race hatred against Russia and Russians? That's pervasive. It's pervasive in the propaganda, and it's one of the features of what we're coming to, of the abuse of emergency power in war, not simply the case of this book, which was about a quarantine for a purported medical reason.
Now, John, what we're talking about, and I noticed this with the U.S. version that's been raising up, is that these people tend to stay in gray areas of law, things that, you know, should be, you know, citizens should have protections from, but no one's thought of it yet. And, you know, you look at the whole cyber social thing going on. There really wasn't any protections written in law about it. And so these people inhabited that area, taking freedoms away from people. Do you see what happened with this situation morphing over to other situations in Australia right now?
Yes, indeed. There are several ways in which it the loss of access to the courts, the subservience of the media, and the collapse of Parliament affect everybody and beyond the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the ways in which this happens is the way in which elections are now run in Australia. Election rules in Australia appear to be very democratic. The turnout is compulsory. You must vote in state elections, federal elections. However, that's no longer what happens. People are now protesting against having to vote by not voting at all. So for the first time, and this is a big surprise to the politicians, big party politicians that I've talked to, for the first time, mm-hmm. you get refusal to vote by up to 10% or more in a particular That's electorate. In addition, you have a system of preferential voting, so that if the two leading candidates fail to achieve a majority of votes, their votes are reallocated to preferences by a preferential system that allows only one candidate to obtain a majority. that essentially multiplies the number of votes each vote has. But the preferential system is now rigged so that that what can be described as a recent landslide victory by the Premier of Victoria, a man called Dan Andrews, was achieved, mm-hmm. although two-thirds of the voters voted against him, two-thirds, and one in five voters either voted informal, scribbled an obscenity on their ballot paper before dropping it in, or didn't vote at all. Two-thirds voted against him for a different candidate, and one in five voted against all. And yet, he voted against him for a different candidate, and one in five voted against all. And yet, he wins an increased number of seats in the state parliament. Now, in the United States, in Russia, in any part of Europe, that system would immediately trigger litigation as to whether it's being rigged. In addition, that particular state election took more than 5 days to count. So some swing seats were won by less than 300, 400 votes under these schemes. Right. Now, as you said, George, a normal North American, US citizen, Canadian citizen, a normal Russian, knows that if the vote takes that long, it settled an outcome by less than 500 votes in a scheme as complicated as distributing preferences. That's a recipe for political corruption. Everywhere in the world that would be understood, but in Australia, it's not understood. Not only was that the outcome in the recent Victorian election in the month of November, but the state government of New South Wales, the state government responsible for the quarantine we've been discussing, that's coming up for election in March 25. That's a few weeks away. The Australian capacity to accept these rules as if they're democratic when they're not, the refusal of parliaments to intervene, to debate the issue, and the total incapacity of the Australian media, whether they're owned by Rupert Murdoch, half of them are, or another corporation or the state, the media refuse to accept this. In fact, they repeat essentially that this is a scheme that's fair and democratic when it isn't, and when nobody in the rest of the world would recognize it that way. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, yeah, it actually does. And quite frankly, you know, you're seeing this play out in different forms, but, you know, the same end result. If you look at Germany's election in 2021, the party that came in third actually won. They came in third, the Green Party. They got the most important seats, and as Schulz leaves, they get the chancellor position. They're free enough to destroy the economy.
It's important,
which is crazy.
George, very important to talk about Germany tonight, or this afternoon. And the reason is that the German situation is deteriorating to several points. Let me make a couple, because one of them concerns the Donbas, one of them concerns the war in the Ukraine. A few days ago, the former chancellor, Angela Merkel, gave an interview to an Italian newspaper in which she repeated some of the things she had said already in German press, to the effect that her policy was to give Ukraine time to arm itself to fight Russia. She repeated that, but she said something more fundamental, more shocking. She said, and I'm quoting now, the Cold War never really ended because Russia was never pacified. Those are the words the former Chancellor of Germany said. Russia was never pacified. That means the Chancellor of Germany had the policy to pacify Germany, no differently from the way the former Chancellor of Germany, known as Adolf Hitler, had that view. The war didn't end in 45 with Hitler's death. Merkel intended to run Ukraine as a gun platform, and you've been feeling the artillery shelling and missile shelling since 2014 in Donbass, Merkel and Germany intended that. Now, as you pointed out, George, in 2021, her party, Merkel's party, the party essentially she destroyed, the Christian Democratic Union, performed so dismally that the combination of the Greens and the SDP formed the weakest coalition running Germany in modern post-war history. A lot of what Merkel has said, and using, let's say, talking out of both sides of her mouth, were intended in 2017 election to keep her herself and her party in power. In 2017, Merkel survived with a swing against her, the Christian Democratic Union and her partners, of 9%. And the Greens began to rise, and the Alliance for Germany, the AfD, began to rise. But the policy of Chancellor Merkel has been to pacify Russia, pacify being a euphemism for making war on Russia and destroy Russia, which is where we are today. But Germany's compliance with this means that Merkel feels quite free to say this was always her objective. And this means also that the war being fought against Russia will not only be fought to the last Ukrainian, it will now be fought, openly admitted, to the last German. Now, how to prevent Germans objecting? The answer was demonstrated by Olaf Scholz and his Green allies a couple of weeks back when they claimed to have uncovered an attempted putsch or coup d'etat on the part of AfD leaders, and rounded 3,000 German special forces and police rounded up us approximately three dozen accused individuals with this allegation they were planning a putsch. Well, the putsch was actually the reverse. The putsch was intended by the Chancellery of Germany to crush the last remaining form of opposition in Germany to this a form of war against Germany to the last German. The AfD was the target of Scholz's actions 2 weeks ago. And so Germany falls into line in this war against Russia, fought right where you are today, George, in Donbass, and extending westward to the Polish border. And the Germans are once again fighting Hitler's war with the support of the United States and the NATO allies. Now, that ought to shock everybody, but it doesn't. Why? Because the propagandizing of Russians as evil is so pervasive everywhere. You can feel it, you can hear it, you can read it everywhere. It's a lie, it's a propaganda, it's racism, it's race hatred.
Well, it's information war. I uncovered the group doing this in 2015. I actually talked to the manager of the InfoWar once in a while. He's managing it out of Virginia. And they were doing this, running this out of the BBG in the State Department, believe it or not. Company you might be familiar with is British, SCL, Strategic Communications Laboratories. Now, they didn't quite go under. There's another part of them that's still up. And the other company, IOTA Global, they're the ones that are doing all this. In March 2021, I actually got a communication from this guy. Hi, I'm back to work. And I said, shit, the war's starting. And that's where the ramp up came. That's when it came. This is beyond propaganda. This is psychological manipulation and warfare. Germany is a big part of this. Now, with Merkel's statements, does Russia have any recourse in any court because she was a guarantor to Minsk?
That's right. And there's, what else? I'm sorry to say that the international court system has been entirely perverted. I emphasize the word perverted, so as to reflect and advance the war aims. For example, there was the recent conclusion of the trial of Russians and one Ukrainian alleged to have shot down Malaysian Airlines flight MH17. That court was rigged from the beginning in the Netherlands to produce a guilty finding, with evidence supplied by the Ukrainian Secret Service, manipulated by the Dutch police, and accepted in secret by secret Dutch judges, whose rulings on witnesses and authenticity of evidence would never be acceptable, never be admissible in a court of law in England, in the United States, Canada, or Australia. And there are, but that particular court was perverted. The Dutch government has now introduced its own litigation in the European courts, including the European Court of Human Rights, to continue the pseudo legal claims against Russia for the MH17 shoot down of July 2014. And the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has proposed a UN tribunal to put Russia on trial for war crimes in the Ukraine. So the question, is there a legal recourse for Russia in this war situation? George, the answer is no. All the courts of recourse, all the independent tribunals of recourse have been won over, distorted, or transformed, whether they deal with the prevention of chemical weapons and warfare, whether they deal with civil aviation safety and so forth. They've all been transformed by this war against Russia. So there is no recourse in law. There is only war. And when the words stop, the battlefield decides. And a series of statements, the most recent of them, Foreign Minister Lavrov, but in the previous week, statements by General Gerasimov, the head of the general staff in Moscow, the President Vladimir Putin, the former President Dmitry Medvedev, and the defense minister have all made very clear statements setting out that the war cannot be resolved by negotiation. The war cannot be ended on the terms the Ukrainians and the United States insist.
We've got about a minute left.
Go ahead.
Please keep going. No, keep going. Listen. I want to have you back.
Happy to be back, George. It's a very difficult, terrible situation for folks where you are. It's a terrible situation for Europeans. But the fact is, there is no recourse except warfare. Only force on the battlefield can decide now. And in this war, there can be no solution or end to the Ukrainian war without an armistice, without a partition of the Ukraine that will prevent the Ukraine become ever in the future a military threat to Russia, to the Novorussian territories, to the Donbass and what have you. But there's no sign that the United States in Washington has any intention of coming to armistice talks, let alone partition talks, for the foreseeable future.
Well, they're already discussing this being a generational war in Kiev. That's where it's actually sitting right now.
It has been a generational war. It's been a generational war since 45. And regrettably, it will continue.